Hey, let's unpack this. We often talk about integrity, right? But what does that word truly mean in our lives? Is it something we just like perform for the world?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it deeper? Something authentic that guides us even when nobody's looking. What happens when that integrity, when it's artificial? Today, we're doing a deep dive into exactly that. Artificial integrity. Our mission, really, is to understand the warning signs. They can be subtle, but incredibly dangerous. Signs of living inauthentically. We'll do this by looking at some really powerful stories from early Christian texts. And we're not just after historical facts here. We're looking for, you know, timeless wisdom we can apply to our own lives and hopefully do it without feeling like we're drowning in information overload. We've actually touched on this theme before in our deep dives. We looked at the Pharisees, remember? Their actions were often purely for public approval, which led to this kind of spiritual emptiness. And King Saul, too, his artificial integrity. It came from not really dealing with sin, always blaming others, treating God's commands like, well, suggestions. So today, we're pushing that exploration further.
Uncovering another crucial layer.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here, and why these ancient stories still hit so hard, is how they give us these timeless insights into just, well, human nature. They really show our universal struggle, you know? Genuine belief versus just putting on a show. And they hold up a mirror to our own hearts, sometimes in pretty surprising ways. Our main source today is excerpts from Artificial Integrity, The Peril of Deception. It dives right into the very beginning days of the Christian church in the New Testament. And it paints this incredibly powerful, almost you could say idyllic picture first, which really sets the stage, creating this strong backdrop to see these themes of authenticity and deception play out. And the consequences are dramatic.
Idyllic backdrop is right.
Yeah.
I mean, just try to imagine the scene. This is right after the Holy Spirit was poured out. A time of just unprecedented spiritual energy.
Yeah, an explosion.
Totally. Our sources talk about the community just exploding in growth, like 3,000 people joining after just one sermon. You had apostles boldly preaching this revolutionary message right in the city where Jesus had been killed.
Right in the heart of it.
And prayer meetings so intense, the buildings they were in actually literally shook.
Yeah.
It wasn't just exciting. It was electric.
Mm.
You could feel the devotion, the connection drawing people in.
Mm-hmm.
The book of Acts, especially chapters 2 and 4, gives us this really vivid picture of the early church. It highlights some pretty revolutionary characteristics.
Yeah.
First, there was this deep, deep devotion. This wasn't just like a casual Sunday thing.
No way.
They were deeply committed to the apostles' teaching, to real fellowship, I mean, a shared life,
yeah,
really to breaking bread together and just constant prayer. It was a whole lifestyle, a way of being.
Absolutely. And that devotion, it wasn't just in their heads, right? It soaked into every part of their lives. It created this atmosphere where signs and wonders weren't weird exceptions. They were almost expected.
Really? Expected.
Yeah, God was displaying many of these through the apostles. And not just for show, not as a spectacle. They were powerful confirmations of his presence, his authority. This fostered a community where people just walked in awe with this real feeling that God was actively, tangibly working among them.
It's honestly hard for us to even wrap our minds around that kind of daily spiritual reality.
Yeah, hard to imagine that level of just expectation. But maybe what truly set them apart and what our source really emphasizes was their radical unity.
Mm-hmm.
The text says they were one in heart and mind. Now, that wasn't just, you know, agreeing on stuff superficially.
No, much deeper.
It was profound, a shared identity. The common bond, the glue holding them together was the Holy Spirit, binding them in this extraordinary, almost like a family kind of way. And it's from that deep unity, that collective spirit, that this equally radical generosity just flowed.
Indeed. And this wasn't simple charity as we might think of it. It was a deeply embedded community commitment. People were actively selling property, possessions, and bringing the money straight to the apostles.
But here's the really key detail. It wasn't for some central fund managed by, like, a committee. The money was laid at the apostles' feet. Why? To be distributed specifically to anyone who had a need.
Anyone.
The goal, and it says this explicitly in Acts 4.34, was that there were no needy persons among them. This wasn't just a nice idea they hoped for. It was real. It was happening.
Oh.
It shows a complete shift in priorities where individual gain was kind of put aside for the well-being of the whole group.
And to give us a real face, a human example of this kind of selfless giving, our sources point to this guy named Joseph. He was a Levite from Cyprus. The apostles actually gave him a nickname, Barnabas, which means son of encouragement.
Oh, Barnabas, yes.
So Barnabas owned a field.
Yeah.
He sells it. And then he brings all the money, every last bit, and lays it at the apostles' feet. He just perfectly embodied that spirit of radical, open-hearted giving.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Barnabas wasn't just, you know, performing an act of charity. His giving came from deep in his heart. It was genuine, selfless, a real commitment. And that authenticity, that genuineness, made him incredibly effective later on. He became essential for spreading the gospel, acting as this crucial link between the Jerusalem church and figures like Saul, who became Paul.
Wow.
So this vibrant, unified, incredibly generous community where need was actually being wiped out, that forms the sharpest possible contrast for the story we're about to get into. It shows us what was possible, what they built, and maybe most importantly, what was at stake when artificiality tried to sneak in.
And here's where it gets really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because against this like shining backdrop of pure devotion, amazing generosity, profound unity, we hit this story that frankly brings a healthy and holy fear, as the source puts it, to anyone who reads it. It's the account of Ananias and Sapphira, found in Acts chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. It's a really dramatic, almost chilling turn in the story.
It really is.
So here's how it unfolds. Ananias and his wife Sapphira, they sold a piece of property. Now, importantly, there was no rule saying they had to sell it.
No compulsion.
And no rule saying they had to give all the money to the church either.
Yeah.
But they agreed together, she knew exactly what was happening, to keep back part of the money for themselves.
Okay.
Now, the problem wasn't keeping a portion. That wasn't the sin.
Right. That's key.
The problem was that Ananias brought the rest of the money to the apostles, but presented it as if it was the full amount from the sale.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted the credit, the reputation of giving everything without actually doing it.
And this is where the confrontation happens and where we see the core issue. Peter, apparently God told him, he just knew what Ananias had done. So he confronts Ananias straight up, asks him, how is it that Satan has so filled your heart that you have lied to the Holy Spirit and have kept for yourself some of the money you received for the land? The absolute crucial point, as our source emphasizes, this wasn't just a fib to Peter or the other leaders.
No.
It was a lie to the Holy Spirit, to God himself.
And the consequence was,
wow,
immediate, severe. As soon as Ananias heard Peter's words, he just fell down dead.
Right there.
Yeah. It sent like a shockwave through this young church, you can imagine. But the story isn't over. About 3 hours later, his wife, Sapphira, comes in. She has no idea what just happened to her husband.
Completely unaware.
Peter, and this seems almost merciful in a way,
gives
her a clear chance to tell the truth. He asks her directly if that amount, the money Ananias brought, was the price they got for the land.
A direct question.
A chance.
And she lies. She confirms the fake amount. Peter then hits her with this chilling question. How could you conspire to test the Spirit of the Lord?
Hmm.
And at that very moment, she also falls down dead. And they carried her out and buried her next to her husband.
It just raises such a huge question for people reading this today, doesn't it? Why such an extreme, immediate public consequence for what looks, maybe to our modern eyes, like fudging the numbers a bit?
Yeah, it seems harsh.
The severity really hammers home how serious their deception was in that context. Peter's words are the key. The lie was not to humans, but to God. Think about it. The church was brand new. It was being built on truth, unity, the real presence of the Holy Spirit. A deception like this, an attempt to basically defraud God right at the foundation, it just couldn't be allowed to stand.
Mm.
It was a foundational moment. It set this incredibly high standard for authenticity. It wasn't really about the money itself. It was about the integrity of their hearts before God and before the community they were pretending to be part of.
It's a truly sobering story.
Yeah.
And its implications, they echo way beyond that specific time and place. So what does this all mean for us living our lives today? Our source pulls out three really powerful takeaways from this account, three distinct signs of artificial integrity, things we need to recognize and, frankly, guard against in our own lives. These aren't just old stories. They're potent warnings.
Definitely.
The first sign, and it's a really sneaky one, is acting with wrong motives. Ananias and Sapphira, in this story, they wanted to look good, right?
Prestige.
They wanted the approval, the recognition. They wanted to be seen as being on the same spiritual level as Barnabas, who had genuinely given everything.
Mm-hmm.
But their heart condition, the why behind the action, as Peter revealed, was totally impure. Their outward act of giving was just poisoned by selfish intent.
And what's so crucial to get here is the difference between an action that looks good on the outside and a motive that's corrupt on the inside. Barnabas gave from a selfless heart. It was worship. It was community support.
Right.
Ananias and Sapphira's act, even though it looked similar, was just a performance designed to impress people, to get that status without the real sacrifice. It was all about looking righteous, not being righteous.
Our source shares this great little story, an illustration that I think really nails this point.
Yeah.
Okay, picture this. Back in 2007, there's this young boy named Landon. He really, really wants to go to Disney World, like desperately.
Okay. Classic kid goal.
His dad tells him, well, son, we need a truck first.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe half joking, maybe not. So Landon, being a clever kid, goes upstairs, finds a little toy truck,
yep.
comes back down, carefully puts it in his dad's hands and says, here's a truck for you, dad. Now, on the surface, that's kind of sweet, right? A thoughtful gesture.
Sure.
But the motive underneath was totally clear.
Hmm.
He wanted that trip to Disney.
And that's exactly it, isn't it? The outward act, giving the truck, giving the money, can hide a deeply selfish reason. This story helps us see that if we are giving or serving or attending church or doing anything that looks spiritual on the outside, but we're doing it with wrong motives, maybe for recognition or approval or trying to manipulate an outcome, our source suggests that's living a life of artificial integrity.
Yeah.
It's not just about what we do, but the deep down why. It really challenges us to look past the surface of our own actions and ask, what's actually driving me here?
That is a powerful challenge. Mm. Okay, so building on that idea of hidden motives, what's the next layer? What's the second sign of artificiality our source finds in this story?
So the second sign is that Ananias and Sapphira kept back things for themselves. Specifically, they kept back a part of what they had committed, or at least appeared to commit, to give while pretending they had given the whole amount.
Right. The pretense is key.
Exactly. Again, the problem wasn't that they only gave some money. The issue was the deception about the amount they had actually dedicated. They wanted people to think they were giving it all, just like Barnabas, but they weren't willing to follow through.
And our source points out a really crucial detail here, linguistically. The Greek root word used for kept back in this passage is nesphizo.
Nesphizo, okay.
It doesn't just mean holding back in a casual sense. It also carries the meaning of to embezzle or to defraud.
Wow, embezzle, that's strong.
It really is. It implies they were, in a sense, stealing. Stealing from God, or at least stealing from what they had publicly declared was his, by lying about their gift. That word choice just elevates their action way beyond a simple white lie.
Precisely. And this isn't about God demanding everyone sell everything. Our source is clear. God doesn't command every Christian to give away all they own. Remember the rich young ruler? That was specific to his situation, his idolization of money.
Right, that was specific.
The sin of Ananias and Sapphira wasn't having the money or even keeping some of it. Their sin was making a public commitment, or at least creating that appearance, and then deliberately lying about fulfilling it. It was a lie about their truthfulness, their integrity, a lie about their promise before God and the community.
So if we try to bring this into our world today, the source suggests we think about areas where we might be doing something similar,
mm-hmm.
like maybe around tithing, debates about 10% from net versus gross income.
Mm-hmm. Common discussions.
Or maybe you sell a house or a car and you feel led, or even say you're going to give a certain portion to God or a cause.
Right.
But then you hold some back while still maybe letting people think you gave the full committed amount.
Okay.
Or even if you feel God prompting you to give 100% of something and you only give, say, 80%, but present it as the whole thing.
Yeah.
What our source concludes is this. If you keep back a portion of what truly belongs to God or what you committed to the Lord, and then you misrepresent that, you're living a life of artificial integrity. You're basically embezzling from God in the spirit of this passage.
And if we connect that to the bigger picture, it just highlights how incredibly important the sanctity of a promise is, especially a promise made in a spiritual context. It's not about the exact dollar amount they kept back.
No.
It's about the integrity of their word, the truthfulness of their heart before God. They had the freedom to give less. They could have given nothing. But once they made that commitment or pretended to and then deliberately lied about it, it became a direct lie against the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing just destroys trust, not just between people, but between the individual and God. It's a betrayal of your own stated beliefs.
Which brings us right to the third and final sign of artificial integrity our source identifies. Giving under false pretense. This one really ties the whole deception together, doesn't it?
It does.
It focuses on the act itself, making deceptive statements, misrepresenting things, with the clear intent to defraud someone. Ananias and Sapphira's whole plan, their actions, their words, it was all designed to defraud God and to gain this false spiritual status in the community.
Yeah.
They clearly valued attention and looking good more than they valued honesty and humility.
Exactly. It wasn't an accident, not a slip up. It was planned deception. And the story really emphasizes this when Peter asks Sapphira directly, was this the price you received for the land?
Yeah.
What's so striking there, she gets this undeniable, clear chance to be truthful.
Even after Ananias.
Yeah.
Even after what happened to her husband, she could have broken the cycle of deceit right there.
It makes me think of that illustration our source uses, God calling out, Adam, where are you?
Yeah.
In the garden.
God knew where Adam was, obviously. The question was an invitation, an opportunity for Adam and Eve to be truthful, to confess.
A chance for honesty.
And Sapphira tragically failed that test.
Yeah.
She doubled down on the lie. She chose to continue the pretense.
And that choice, that failure of truthfulness, had huge implications for the brand new church. Our source also contrasts their actions with a passage in Malachi chapter 3, verse 10. There, God actually invites us to test him, but in a good way. Through obedience.
Yes, sir.
He says, basically, bring the whole tithe, test me in this, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing. He challenges us to give generously and trust his provision. Ananias and Sapphira, though, they were testing God in the completely opposite way. They were testing boundaries, seeing how far they could push the deception before facing consequences. It's a total reversal of trust and obedience.
So, as our source wraps it up, if you are giving or maybe attending or serving in a church or any community, but it's under a false pretense driven by deception, just to look good, just to gain some kind of social or spiritual points, then you are essentially living a life of artificial integrity.
Which brings us back to that really critical question. Why did God draw such a clear, immediate line in the sand here? Remember, the early church was foundational. It was just starting, establishing its identity, its core message to the world.
Right. The very beginning.
Any deception right at the heart of it, especially about spiritual commitment and honesty, could have poisoned the whole well. It could have fatally compromised the entire message and mission. Their lie wasn't just some minor thread within a big established organization. It was an attempt to deceive the Holy Spirit himself right in the cradle of this new global movement.
Wow.
It was such a critical error in judgment and integrity that it had to be dealt with decisively to protect the authenticity of the whole thing. It set a precedent. Truth and authenticity were absolutely non-negotiable.
So what does this all mean for us today? Living in a world that, let's be honest, often seems to value appearance way more than substance.
Yeah, that pressure is real.
The story of Ananias and Sapphira and all the sources we've looked at, they deliver a really clear message, maybe even an unsettling one. God sees your heart. He knows your real motives. You simply cannot feel God.
Mm-hmm.
This deep dive really pushes us, I think, to look inward, to reflect honestly on those key things, our hidden motives, the commitments we make, big or small, and how faithfully we actually follow through.
Mm-hmm.
And whether we're ever tempted, even subtly, to act under false pretenses just to, you know, look good to others.
Ultimately, yeah, this whole deep dive kind of challenges us at a core level. Are we truly surrendering our control, our motives, everything we claim belongs to a higher purpose? Are we cultivating a genuine integrity, one that thrives even in the dark when no one else is watching? Or are we just, you know, performing?
Performing, yeah.
The ultimate question that our source leaves us with is really a call to radical self-honesty. Will you surrender your heart, your life, truly and authentically? Will you commit to living without that artificiality? It's a powerful invitation, really, to examine the real nature of our own beliefs and actions and to pursue an integrity that isn't fake, isn't put on, but is deeply, uncompromisingly real.